Welcome back, everybody, to the Movie Palace. As ever, I'm your host, Carl Sweeney, and thank you for joining me again this week. So, as you'll all know, the 2019 Academy Awards ceremony is only days away now. So on the podcast this week, we're continuing to look at a film that has won the Oscar for Best Picture in the past, namely, this week, Fred Zinnemann's From Here to Eternity, released in 1953. A film, of course, as you all know, starring Burt Lancaster, Montgomery Clift and Deborah Carr, as well as Frank Sinatra and Donna Reed. And joining me this week, I'm delighted to say, is film critic and blogger Raquel Stetcher. Hello, Raquel.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's nice to talk to you again. How have you been getting on?
Busy with a lot of films and a lot of writing, which is my happy place.
Sounds good to me. Really does. Yeah, as I said, the Oscar's only days away. So I just thought we'd start, as I've been asking people on the podcast recently, just a bit of general chat, you know, your opinions on the Oscars. I mean, are you an enthusiast when it comes to the Academy Awards? I mean, do you follow them quite closely or not?
So I have a hate-love relationship with the Oscars. Actually, many people do, so I'm sure a lot of people can relate. I love the pomp and circumstance and the history behind the Oscars. And as marketing, it's just fantastic because if somebody wins, or even if they're nominated, it's such a great boost to their career to say, this is an Academy Award nominated actor or actress, or Academy Award winning director. That is such a boost for a career. So in the industry, it's incredibly important, but it's also incredibly arbitrary. And it pits all these wonderful performances against each other. It's an objective decision, because who gets to say who's the best? And also, it's the best of the year. So a lot of people complain, oh, well, why did this film win? But then this film a few years later didn't win and it was more worthy. Well, it's pitting against the best of the year, not the best of all time. So it is very subjective and, yeah, also very arbitrary, but it's also a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's pretty similar to how I feel, to be honest. I'm glad you used the word arbitrary, because I think that's a good word. I think I've seen a quote somewhere. I want to say it was from Humphrey Bogart, but I'm not 100% sure. But he said that, you know, if you're going to judge best actor, really what you need to do is get five people who all played Hamlet, you know, as in, you know, you're kind of comparing apples and oranges sometimes. I think even if you had five adaptations of Hamlet, it'd still be kind of arbitrary, I think.
And you could have a year where you have a lot of really wonderful films and performances, and then you could have a year where most of them are not that great. So, I mean, it's really difficult.
Yeah, you definitely do get like years like that. And you also get like sometimes you go back 10 years later and you look and you think, wow, time hasn't been kind to such and such a film.
Exactly.
What about the night itself then? I mean, do you watch the ceremony? Because I don't anymore, because I don't have the channel where it's which is broadcast on in the UK. I used to enjoy it quite a lot, but it's been a few years. These days I just follow it via Twitter, basically. But how about you?
So there are so many awards, award ceremonies to watch, and I will only watch the Oscars because it's a huge time commitment. I have so many other things I'm doing. And then also it's always on a school night. I always have to go to work the next day. So I will watch it. I probably won't watch the whole thing unless it's a year in which I've seen most of the nominated films. That's when I get super excited about the Oscars and I'm really committed to watching the whole ceremony. And if I have missed several of them, then I won't be as interested. So it really does depend on my level of interest in the films that are being showcased.
Yeah, and I mean, we're pre-recording this, so we can't pass an opinion on this year's nominees. We haven't even seen the nominations yet, I don't think, but I mean, as you said, there are lots of award ceremonies. It becomes this kind of race, doesn't it? And, you know, the companies are spending all this money on promotion and their campaigns and so on. And I just wonder sometimes it has kind of a warping effect where everybody seems to get caught up in the excitement and the drama of it. And I don't know, at some point it stops being about the films and it becomes being about kind of, I don't know, like the arms race that kind of surrounds it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, a lot of what it is these days is entertainment value, seeing these celebrities in their full attire and watching their award acceptance speeches and, you know, kind of being caught up in the moment of disappointments and and surprises and things like that. And also the Oscars are so long now, like they pack as much entertainment as they can in there. But that's also a problem because they go on way too long. And who knows, by the time when this comes out, maybe they'll have picked a host, because right now there is none.
There's been the whole thing with Kevin Hart, hasn't there, this year? Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, we'll leave that to one side, and we're here to talk specifically about From Here to Eternity, a film which did really well at the Oscars, actually. You know, a film that was a big success for Columbia Pictures, an adaptation of the novel by James Jones, which I haven't read, I'll confess, straight up. Lots of people know, of course, but it's a film that, you know, primarily concerns, you know, the fortunes and the misfortunes of a group of soldiers stationed in Hawaii in the months leading up to the attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941, including their kind of romantic attachments. And I was very pleased, you know, it had been many years since I'd seen this film, so it was a pleasure to sit down and watch it again this week in advance of this. But Raquel, how about you? What are your overall thoughts on this film? You're fond of this one, aren't you?
Yes, I think this is one of the best films of all time, and it's generally considered a World War II film, but really it's just for me, it's a film about these people who don't want to conform, who want to be true to themselves. And the conduit for that story is the army life on Oahu days before the attack on Pearl Harbor. And one of the things I think is fascinating about this film is all the drama that's happening between these characters, and they don't know that this major event is about to happen and their lives are going to be completely transformed. And some don't even make it to that point, but we know the whole time. So I think one of the strengths of this film is how the audience has some knowledge and power in understanding something that the characters on screen don't. I think that's a great strength of the film.
Yeah, I had a similar note about that, actually, and it kind of surprised me going back that the screenwriter's making a really interesting choice not to focus too much on what's going on kind of off base, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, we see a few newspaper headlines that the guys are kind of reading, don't we?
And yeah.
I think at one point, Burt Lancaster's character says, in 6 months we'll be at war. He's kind of supposing that's what will happen, but that's about it, I think, until the climactic attack, as far as I can recall. But like you say, it's that we know what's coming down the line, don't we? Because, you know, especially there's a shot at one point where Lancaster stood next to a calendar, I think.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it really is. It really generates like this sense of foreboding, I think, doesn't it?
Yeah, and this is where the audience has full knowledge and the characters have no clue. Like, it says December 6, 1941. We know exactly what's going to happen the next day, but they don't.
So, as I said, I mean, this is one that did extremely well at the Oscars. From what I've read, it kind of went in as the favorite. Was it a deserving Best Picture winner? I mean, I think you've kind of answered this if you think it's one of the best films of all time. But it was up against, Julius Caesar, The Robe, Roman Holiday and Shane. So I haven't seen Julius Caesar or The Robe. I have seen Roman Holiday and Shane. How about you, Raquel? You think this is a clear winner on this occasion?
I haven't seen all of them either. I've seen Julius Caesar and Roman Holiday. I haven't seen Shane or The Robe. I feel like I could say it's the deserving winner, but it would be more fair if I had seen all five and then made a decision that way. But for me, in terms of films from this era, and even in comparing it with Roman Holiday, to me, this is the clear winner.
Yeah, I would have voted for this over Roman Holiday. I do like Roman Holiday quite a bit, actually. I'd have been very torn, I think, between this film and Shane. I really like Shane. But I can see why this would have been the one they went for, I think, because, you know, because it's such serious subject matter, because it's, you know, such a great cast. And there's a lot going for this film, I think. And, you know, it won multiple awards. It won Best Director for Zinnemann. Best Supporting Actor for Sinatra, Best Supporting Actress for Donna Reed, mm-hmm. Best Screenplay, Best Sound Recording, Best Cinematography for a black and white film for Burnett Guffey, and Best Editing. So that's quite a haul, isn't it? You know, it came away, it had a good night.
Yeah, and I mean, if you think about it in the context of the time, in 1950s Hollywood, they were competing big time with television. And television was basically taking a lot of their viewers away from them because people just wanted to be at home, relaxing, watching their entertainment, then going out to the theater. So they had to really deliver when they did release films. And one of the things that Robert Osborne said in his Oscars book, which I think is just perfect and speaks to the strength of the film, is that he said they put first-class actors in offbeat roles. And I think this is why this is such a strong contender for an Oscar, just for Best Motion Picture, but also for the wins and the nominations for the actors as well, is that all of the actors got to play either completely opposite of what they're normally playing or something completely different that they could really showcase their talents. And I think that comes off very clear in the movie and why this is so good.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, I mentioned the winners there, but it also, you know, nominations in other categories too, including for Clift and Lancaster and Carr. So yeah, totally agree with what you say. And for people who want kind of a flavor of what it was like back in 54, I think YouTube can be people's friend here, can't it, Raquel? There's plenty of stuff up on the Academy Awards kind of YouTube channel.
Oh, the Academy Awards YouTube channel is my favorite YouTube channel. And they have, I would suggest going through their playlist because they have some hidden videos that you can't search for, but are available if you go to their playlist. So they have almost all, or maybe all of the the Academy Awards would have been 1954 for this one. And so you can go and watch the 26th Academy Awards and see all of the acceptances, all the announcements and the acceptance speeches. And what I love about it too is that it's totally different from what they do today. Like, for example, when Donna Reed won for Best Supporting Actress, she was sitting in the way back and she had to run down the aisle to get to the stage. And Walter Brennan almost like dragged her off the stage because they had such little time to give acceptance speeches. So she just gave a couple of lines. She made kind of like this cute little remark of like, from here to eternity and eternity to here. And then she was just whisked off stage. But that's so different. They would see everyone at the front now, and speeches go on maybe a little too long. And there's a dramatic reel of all the performances before the actual winner is announced. So it's very different.
I wonder why that is, that the supporting nominees were so far back. Do you think they're just kind of supporting? Oh, you know, they're not the stars. They can sit back there. I don't know.
Possibly. I don't know how that. I mean, there's whole politics of how they seat people in the Oscars. So I wonder how it is different now than it was back then. It seemed very interesting.
Yeah, and a couple of things I've read about this particular year's ceremony. I think, like you said, quite tightly controlled. So apparently the ceremony only ran for a couple of hours. Mm-hmm. And whenever I've watched the Oscars, I think you're normally looking at like 3-4 hours, aren't you, these days? And,
right.
Like you say, people being played off stage because their speech is going too long and that kind of thing.
Exactly.
And the other thing I heard, which is interesting because you mentioned television, but I think maybe that had an effect because I heard that in terms of people who turned out, like fans outside the arena or whatever, I heard this was like the skimpiest crowd in some years because it had become this television event by this point. So that was fascinating.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
And one thing that's super interesting too about Oscar ceremonies from that era is they used to say, and the winner is, and they don't do that anymore. Now it's the Academy Award goes to. So there's been a lot of changes. It's gone longer and there's some different types of politics involved.
Yeah, and I think when the Oscars first started, I think that all the winners knew in advance, you know, it was kind of announced beforehand and people just turned up for the prize giving or whatever. And obviously then at some point it became this dramatic concept of unveiling it on stage. Yeah, it's definitely changed a lot over the years. Right, so as we've mentioned there, you know, it had these acting awards and nominations. And I think this is it's a great film as a star vehicle for some great performers, in my opinion. So I thought we could just talk about each of them kind of in turn. A little. So maybe starting with Montgomery Clift, actually, who plays Robert E. Lee Pruitt. You know, Clift, a great actor, in my opinion. One of these guys who came along and seemed to really shake up the art of like film acting in a very interesting way, you know, often grouped with people like Marlon Brando or James Dean, you know. These guys who could summon up just an incredible like intensity. And I think, you know, he certainly brings his intensity to bear on this role, doesn't he?
I agree. I mean, he was totally a method actor and he really threw himself into this role. And the role of Pruitt he's a very moody character. He's got this past, this tragic event that happened to him where he was boxing and he injured his friend and his friend went blind and he doesn't want to box anymore. So he's got this internal struggle, but he also wants to fit in with army life, but he doesn't want to lose his own identity. So there's all this struggle that's going on. And Montgomery Clift was so good at showing that intensity and that internal struggle through just his performance, which is, I mean, kind of mind-boggling. I don't even know how he does that.
Yeah, I think he was very good at like playing sort of troubled and wounded. Mm-hmm. And in this film, it's almost like he's quite, I don't know, almost like he's quite a pure soul in a way, in the sense that it's not that he's untroubled by convention or anything, but he's, like you say, he's very principled. He's trying to maintain his identity, and he'll do what it takes to do that, you know. So this thing about he doesn't want a box, mm-hmm. no matter what kind of pressure they put on him, you know. But obviously the character finds that increasingly difficult as the film wears on, doesn't he? And he sort of turns to drink, and, you know, he eventually does exhibit his kind of violent side and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, he has a very strong sense of identity, does not want to give it up. And basically the entire film is us watching him go through the struggle of not wanting to conform.
And I think that one aspect of the film that comes through the character of Pruitt that I really enjoyed, and I couldn't quite remember actually, is the way music's used in a variety of different ways in this film, you know.
Oh, and yes.
One of the first things we learn about him is he's a bugler. Mm-hmm. And there's that great scene later on where we first hear him play it, you know, and it starts to kind of ingratiate him a bit more with his colleagues. I think that'd probably be one of my favourite moments from the film, actually. But yeah, it's a very musical film, isn't it, actually? Surprisingly so.
Yeah, I mean, there were, in this last viewing that I had, I noticed some things that I hadn't noticed before about how they injected the film with a lot of 1940s music to give it that sense of time. For example, Ernest Borgnine is playing the Hutsut song on the piano when he and Frank Sinatra have their first kind of like confrontation. And then there's this really hilarious scene later in the film where Frank Sinatra is like dramatically putting powder all over himself. Yeah. And he's sort of humming to the Chattanooga Choo Choo. And I love 1940s music. So I was starting to pick up on those things, and it was really fun.
Yeah, and also stuff like where they're all sat around strumming the guitar and singing. I think the song's Re-Enlistment Blues. I think that comes up in a couple of occasions. There's also the scene where, like, Sergeant Warden and Karen, they're sat talking while there's a band playing, you know, off to the side. And I think it all kind of enhances the film, doesn't it? It kind of adds to the sense that, kind of adds to the sense of authenticity, I suppose.
Yes, I agree. And the director, Fred Zinnemann, was all about that, so it totally makes sense for the film.
Mm. And as you say, so there's that scene with Sinatra humming that tune, you know. So obviously a film here that has one of the 20th century's most renowned singers, really. I mean, it's a fairly well-known story, I think, but this is like a pivotal point in Sinatra's career, certainly in terms of his film performances. But he'd kind of gone through the doldrums is kind of a story, isn't it? He'd had kind of a bleak time, but then he starts to turn it around in the sort of mid-50s, doesn't he?
Yeah, I mean, this period in his career has the best performances between 1953 and 1955, where we get the humble Frank Sinatra, who's really trying to turn around everything. He is absolutely smitten with this part. He read the novel. The character in the novel, Maggio, is pretty much him. So it seemed like a perfect fit, even though he really had to sell himself because they really wanted Eli Wallach and or other people to play it. So he was devoted to this character, and he was at such a low point in both his singing and acting career that he knew that this was his moment to shine. This was a role that could get him an Oscar nomination and an Oscar win. He knew that, like, this was the opportunity, and he opened his own doors for it. So that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, and in terms of like his musical career, that starts to pick up too, because I think some of his best albums from around this time, like he did one called In the Wee Small Hours that I really like in 55, mm-hmm. and then he did one called Songs for Swinging Lovers in 56, and I think they're two of his best records. So kind of he was on the upswing after this, and it's such a good role, isn't it, in the sense that, you know, compared to some of the others, maybe it's a bit more limited in terms of screen time, but he's afforded the opportunity to show what he can do in a number of ways, isn't he? Because he gets to play kind of someone who's very likable, you know, very expressive, someone who's very demonstrative. But he also, you know, gets to play drunk, you know, he gets to get some conflict, and he gets quite a intense death scene as well, doesn't he? So he had a lot of, you know, different things to do. Do you think he pulled them all off kind of successfully?
I'm not terribly a fan of the death scene, but I think all the other scenes are fantastic. I think he does a really great performance in this. And one thing, too, is he and Pruitt are both misfits. They don't really fit in the army culture. And but they are total opposites of each other too, because, you know, Pruitt's the moody, kind of more quiet type, and Maggio is very fun-loving, but they also have a lot of things in common. They're very protective of who they are. They don't want to change because of what the army is telling them to, and they're both suffering quite a lot of emotional and physical abuse by their superiors. So they have a lot in common, even if personality wise they're different. So those two play off each other very well. But I think this, because the character is very much like Sinatra in personality, just in real life, that it, he just carries it off kind of seamlessly.
So you mentioned the death scene there, and to be honest, I have the same kind of view, to be honest. But so what do you mean though? You just didn't quite buy it or something like that?
Well, I don't know. It just, it was a little overdramatic. It, you kind of know it's coming because you hear of all, I mean, we don't get to see the abuse. That's one of the things that they made a point not to show, Ernest Borgnine actually beating Frank Sinatra. But we hear about the level of abuse he's going through. So you know that something's going to happen to him. But it's almost anticlimactic in how they did it. I just, I don't know. I don't know if they could have done it differently. But I don't know. It just, it felt kind of flat to me. But it was a good moment for Frank Sinatra to, because a death scene is always a good acting moment for somebody.
Well, yeah, especially if you're in line for, if you got your eye on an Oscar and that kind of thing, I suppose. No, it was definitely a shrewd choice, though, wasn't it, to take on like a plum supporting role like this. You know, it's much more common with stars these days, isn't it, that, you know, these days there are a lot of top performers who'll alternate between playing the lead or being supporting, or going from movies to TV, or whatever. It was much less common with big stars then, but it was a calculated move, you know. And Sinatra, just one of those guys, so interesting, because he was obviously a genuine movie star, but also, you know, his celebrity was in no way kind of confined to that. So just one reason I think he's such a significant figure, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, and what one of the strengths of this movie, too, is an all-star cast. And but you don't feel like any of the main players don't get enough screen time. Even with Frank Sinatra, his part is not very, it's not, he doesn't have a lot of screen time, and his death happens not too early on, but somewhat early on. So he is limited, but you don't feel like he's not there enough. Like, you feel like he's got enough time for his character to shine and for us to get to know him a little bit. And I felt that way for all of the characters. There's a lot of really big characters, but they all are given enough of a platform and enough screen time for us to really get to know them.
Yeah, and one of the characters who gets quite a bit to do is Karen, played by Deborah Carr, who I think is very good in the role, you know. And I think the presentation of her is quite interesting in the sense that, you know, she has this reputation that some of the male characters discuss, don't they, where, you know, it sounds like she's known for her affairs. And later we discover the backstory that involves the loss of the baby and being unable to conceive and that kind of thing. She describes herself as a washout at one point. And of course, like, her marriage is basically broken. So there's quite a bit going on with her character, isn't there?
Yeah. And I think her, like with the other characters, is struggling with identity. I mean, she's like the army housewife, and she's got all this, yeah, as you said, a broken past and a husband that's cheating on her, and she's trying to match him affair to affair. So she's unhappy with the role that she's fulfilling, because she knows that that's not really her. So I just, and also this is a very different character for Deborah Carr. I mean, this is a very passionate, strong-willed woman, not reserved or like maybe very uppity in terms of like some of her other characters that she played in this era. This is a very like, very strong emotional character, and it was a great part for her.
Yeah, and do you feel like, is there any sense that there's like a double standard in the sense that the characters, in the way that the characters seem to approach like male and female like infidelity? Because it seems like in the case of Karen, you know, it seems like to kind of be a defining aspect of her in a way that isn't quite the same for her husband, even though we know he's cheating too and so on. But it's not discussed in the same way by the others, is I guess is what I mean.
Oh, for sure.
Maybe the difference, though, is that ultimately she appears much more sympathetic in the eyes of the audience compared to him, despite the way, you know, some of the male characters are quite dismissive of her, you know?
I mean, it's important for us to know that in terms of like it, to see how people are talking about her behind her back. Like, for example, when Burt Lancaster's warden, like another character comes up to him and said, oh yeah, I've been one of those guys and the string of guys that she's had. And then you see his jealousy. Yeah, it is definitely a double standard, but it's also important for us to know like what she's dealing with. Like these people are murmuring behind her back. She's been giving a bad reputation when she's not really a bad person. She's just in a bad situation.
Yeah. And of course, so a key aspect of the film is then the romance between her and Burt Lancaster's character, Milt Warden, you know, and I really enjoyed this aspect of the film. I thought the two of them had great like interpersonal chemistry, you know, and I think you sort of see that in the way they look at one another. There seemed to be a real kind of spark to it. I mean, what do you think of their pairing, first of all, before we move on? There's obviously a famous kind of love scene between the pair of them. But in general, what did you think of their them as a couple?
I hope you don't mind. I have to compare the couples because I think it's really interesting how the two romances play out. But the Lancaster Carr romance is just so fiery and passionate. I mean, you get like they're like he visits her and it's raining and she doesn't want to let him in and she lets him in and then they have this moment together. But it's like a very much like a I'm crazy for you, but I also don't like you very much. And then they have this passionate scene later in the water. And I think that's it. That's the crux of their relationship, is that for their relationship, it's a lot of lust and physical attraction and some feeling. But when you look at the other couple played by Montgomery Clift and Donna Reed, they have such a tender romance where they care very much about each other. Alma gives Pruitt a key to her house. He sees beyond her being like a dance hall. You know, it's suggested that she's a prostitute, basically. He sees beyond that. And they have this very tender, caring relationship, which they, I think it's really great. And those two romances, they're so different. But they, because they're so different, they're opposites of each other, they help you understand the, or get the impact of what each relationship is. So I think that's really kind of special.
Yeah, and like you're saying, they're very different people, but I also like the way that the romances seem to proceed almost along parallel lines, you know, like both pairs, they seem to get together at about the same time. There are scenes very close to each other where both men display jealousy of one sort. Both couples have one person who has quite a traumatic backstory in the sense of Clift's boxing story and Carl's, you know, her backstory about the child. And so on, and not being able to conceive. So I thought there was, and also there are later on there are some consecutive scenes where they're sort of discussing like what happens in the future and stuff like that. So yeah, I think the people are very different, but there's also a nice structure there, the way that both parallel storylines are handled, it seemed to me. And so to go back to Lancaster and Carl then, so I think that in older movies especially, I think on-screen kissing is very important to viewers who enjoy romance narratives, and I think it's probably because, you know, the kiss scene kind of doubles up as a substitute almost for other forms of like physical intimacy that obviously couldn't be depicted on screen at that time, you know. So there's that scene on the beach and it's quite a tumultuous scene, isn't it? And she says, you know, at one point, nobody ever kissed me like that before. So it's kind of a doozy of a love scene, really, on the beach, I think. And it's one that's justly famous, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, just when you get to that scene, there's crashing waves and they're, you know, running towards the beach and they're running into the water and they like dramatically like fall onto the sand and the kiss and the waves crash over them. It is like an incredibly electric scene, a very sexual scene without actually showing anything that couldn't get past the censors at the time. So, and that's why it's become such an iconic scene, because it depicts something in a very subtle way, but also in a very dramatic way at the same time. And it's become so iconic. Like, some people will know the scene before they even know the movie or they've even seen the movie. Yeah, it's very powerful.
Yeah, I've even heard rumors, Raquel, that some people will actually seek out the beach, you know, and take photographs and find the exact spot and stuff like that. Have you heard that too?
Oh, guilty. Yes. So my husband and I are total movie nerds. And on our honeymoon in Hawaii, we went film location searching. And one of the places we wanted to find the Schofield Barracks, which are where most of the scenes are shot, but it's an active army barracks and we weren't sure we were going to get in there. So we went to go find Halona Cove, which is where the beach is in that scene. And it's on the very southeast tip of the island. So you go from Honolulu past Waikiki Beach, past Diamond Head, and you'll find it. What you don't see in the film is actually it's at the very bottom of a big cliff. And to get down there is quite dramatic because there are some very jagged rocks that take you down. And it's very, precarious. I almost didn't make it down there. I was very scared when my husband encouraged me. And one thing, too, this is just a beach, right? But this is the most recognizable beach because when I got down there, it looked exactly like it did in the movie. The rock formations and the sand and everything, you could tell this is the beach that was from Here to Eternity, which is unusual because beaches don't look in a way that is a recognizable way that you know where you are. It's just a beach. This is different. So if you're in Hawaii, I highly recommend checking it out.
I think there must have been, people over the years who've just gone there to kind of recreate the scene. I think you just took a few pictures, didn't you, Raquel? You didn't get down on the sand and kind of...
There were families there swimming and little kids, so we didn't think it was appropriate. So we just... I just did a lot of pointing.
So, I mean, maybe you could tell me a bit more about Hawaii because, it's a location I've obviously seen in various films. I've never been there myself, but the way it appears like on screen, I don't know, it comes across as being obviously, I don't know, maybe like a very sensuous location or something. And definitely in this film, it's an interesting setting in the sense that I think a lot of the shots are kind of livened up a bit by, there's interesting hills or trees or whatever in the frame. And like you say, there are distinctive settings like the beach too, but... What do you think? You've got the experience of actually having spent a bit of time there. So how well did this film capture Hawaii?
I think it's really interesting because Hawaii was a big military base for the United States, especially during World War II, because of its location in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Yeah. Makes sense. So when you go visit Oahu, you do get that military sense. Because you see, actual Pearl Harbor itself and the museum. And we went to the USS Arizona. I mean, that's military history big time there. And then you have the Schofield Barracks, which take up quite a lot of space kind of in the center of the island. So it is, you get that military feel that this is an important base for our presence in World War II. But you also get the tropical aspects of, Halona Cove and seeing Waikiki Beach and even seeing like little streets in Honolulu where they're going into bars and, listening to music and having some drinks. Mm-hmm. It's got a great sense of setting because of that. And I also even really liked when they sent Montgomery Clift's character out to do a hike. And that was that's part of the Schofield Barracks. They have some natural reserve, so you get a great sense of setting there. And one thing too, which is super interesting, is Hawaii was not a state yet. It became a state, the 50th state, actually, or maybe the 49th, in 1959. So even when the film was made, this is not the United States. They talk about, when I go back to the states. But this is very much, they are somewhere else. They are in a tropical place that's another place. So they don't feel like they're in the United States. And that's something that this film captures. And it's very much a part of early 20th century history.
Mm. Just to bring it back very quickly to the stars, because I think we should maybe give Donna Reed a bit more of a moment in the spotlight, because I think she's really good. And it's a nice role for her, I think, and it's one that plays off her image in quite a shrewd way, in the sense that, when we first see her, this is this big departure, isn't it? This is not the kind of thing you'd typically associate with Donna Reed, I guess.
No, it's true. I mean, she played all these very sweet, like either ingenues or just like sweet, romantic characters. I mean, if you compare this with It's a Wonderful Life, this is a totally different character. But she's playing a character who's also struggling with her identity. She's trying to be like this kind of prostitute at this, not brothel, but it's like a dance hall. Mm. But she doesn't fit in with any of the other girls. She's in the way back. She's not really interested in this. So you kind of get a sense. It's almost like Donna Reed's playing somebody she's not, but she's still being true to herself. And the character herself is also trying to play a role that's not herself, but also kind of trying to be true to herself too. So I think it was a really good match for her.
Yeah, because that's what I was going to say, is that I think, so immediately, you know, at first it's this big departure, but then in some ways it kind of swings around, I think, because like we find out then that she hails from a small town, it sounds like. Mm-hmm. We find out that her actual name is a bit less exotic than this assumed name she had. So we thought it was Laureen, and then it becomes Alma. And then as the film wears on, you know, we see her in different settings, like her home, don't we, where she kind of drops the act a bit. And, you know, I think at one point Pruitt says, you know, it's like being married when he first goes home with her. And then she talks about it as well. She says, you know, I want to build a home. I want to be a proper wife to somebody someday.
I think that's what's great, is that it's a sort of stretch for her, but also on familiar ground. So it kind of plays to two aspects of her character, that she can really stretch herself as an actress, but still play something that she's good at.
Now, so like I said at the outset, I haven't read From Here to Eternity. I don't know if you have or not, Raquel.
I have not, but I have understood that it's a lot more critical of the army and a lot more salacious in terms of the relationships and the roles of the characters.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing I'd heard, you know, and it sounds like the portrayal of the military then is softened a bit from the book. You know, if the filmmakers wanted to ensure they could get some cooperation to allow for, like, location shooting and things like that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, some plot points are altered. I believe that some stuff involving, like, gonorrhea in the book, apparently, obviously isn't in the film. But I don't know, I still think in terms of the portrayal of the military, I think the filmmakers did a good job, because I think you sort of get different sides of it. You know, one of the things I really like is you do get a sense of the kind of community that kind of comes through with the guys. You know, they do things together, like playing pool and music and boxing and going out on the town. But there's obviously like a darker side to this kind of thing too, when you get somebody like Montgomery Clift's character who doesn't exactly play ball, and that sort of creates these tensions, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was interesting how they got the army to be on board for this, because it is actually very quite critical. You see a lot of the abuse that Pruitt has to go through based on something that just he didn't want a box, and they really wanted him in a box. So they put him through terrible things. And then what happens to Maggio is just terrible. And you know that that stuff really happened. It's just, it's really frightening. But yeah, you get a sense of community too. Like, I love how one of the clubs that they go to is called the Enlisted Man's Club. So you know that there's this huge, like, culture on the island of these army men who just, like, get together and they bond both on the base and off the base. But yeah, it is, I have to say, for a film about this era, it's very, very critical of the army. And I was surprised how much they actually got away with.
I mean, there's a scene where they're in the club, I think, and they're kind of eyeing up this waitress called Rose. And I think Burt Lancaster's character says, "I like to watch you walk," or something like that. And so, yeah, maybe some aspects of the book are watered down, but, you know, these are still kind of red-blooded guys in ways that are not always ideal or sympathetic, I suppose.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting, the Fatso Judson character, how... I mean, he's very ruthless, but you don't see a lot of his actual evil acts. They happen off screen, but you get enough of a sense that you know that this guy's just bad news. And what I think is interesting, if we want to call out Ernest Borgnine's performance, is the fact that the next year he played Marty and won the Oscar for that role, and that was the complete opposite of this character. Yeah. That was a very sweet, lovable, you know, single guy looking for love. And this guy is just completely evil. So that speaks to Borgnine's strengths as an actor. It's amazing.
Yeah, his kind of versatility. Yeah. In terms of these guys, though, I think like Montgomery Clift's character says, Pruitt says at one point, you know, "We may seem all alike, we ain't alike," you know. And the film does make sure to give him this scene where he talks about how much he loves the army. You get the sense that the army, from what he says, you know, helped him to learn skills and instilled in him a sense of belonging in some way. So they do include these elements, I think, that perhaps they were at the behest of the military, I'm not quite sure, but the film stops short, I think, of becoming too preachy, though, even if it does have these kind of balancing elements included.
There's actually a great line that I had missed on previous viewings that quite shocked me, which kind of the opposite, where it's basically Captain Holmes, who's Philip Ober's character, Karen's husband, basically. I think he's talking to Burt Lancaster's character about Montgomery Clift and what they're doing to him. And he says, "You can't be decent to a man like that. You have to treat him like an animal." And that really shocked me this time. And because they're putting him through such abuse. So there's like, yeah, so they really do balance. Like there's some moments when you're like, wow, this is just terrible. But then you're like, they have to be in this for a reason. So the sense of community and this desire to serve their country and to, as you said, learn new skills. So it's a balance of like good and bad that they're showing.
I mean, let's talk a bit about the style of the film because, you know, as I said earlier, you know, like Oscar-winning cinematography and so on. And I don't know, I think the film's got this very like sober, serious feel, it seems like to me. I think maybe the black and white plays into that in the sense that if this had been a colour film, maybe more of a sense of spectacle, maybe the temptation would have been for that to come to the fore or something. But it's quite unflashy, isn't it? I mean, the cinematography and Zinnemann's style, they don't seem as if they're calculated to attract attention just for the sake of it, for the most part, anyway. Would you agree?
Yeah, I really think that the cinematography in this film is focused on the characters because the shots are so tight. I mean, you have a lot of, like, just for example, when Maggio dies and then you have that great scene of Montgomery Clift playing the bugle and he's crying. That shot is just like, that frame is all Montgomery Clift's face. Like, these are some really tight shots, really focusing on the characters. You have this beautiful setting. You have some of that, but there's not a lot of scenes where you get kind of like a great sense of the exotic location. It's very focused. And a lot of the shots, especially on the Schofield barracks, are formations of people. You see like the arrangements, like a shot down a long hall and people coming out of doors or people getting into alignment for marching. And so there's a lot of the cinematography is focusing on the actual people versus maybe some fancier shots of setting or although the total exception of that is the beach scene, because that timing is perfect of the wave and the beach and everything. That's amazing. But yeah, it's very focused on the actors.
Yeah, well, I think that's definitely like a justified exception, I suppose. But no, I think you're right. I think that they seem to find a way to do things that are very effective in their simplicity. Like that scene you mentioned with the bugle, and I agree, like the close-ups are phenomenal and so on.
Yeah.
But the shot before that of Maggio's empty bed, you know, that's been stripped after his death, you know.
That is a powerful shot.
It is. It achieves a real, like, poignancy, I think. And it's definitely the right stylistic approach in my view. But at the same time, when they wanted to inject a bit of energy, they can and they do. So the scene I'm thinking of is when Pruitt gets in the fight later on in the film, you know, suddenly the editing picks up in pace. It's quite rapid and it's just entirely appropriate. So I guess it was done very intelligently, I think. It was done very purposefully.
And I wonder, too, if the Oscar win was really because of that one famous beach scene. I always wonder about how they award these, like sound editing and cinematography. I wonder if a lot of the focus is on something that became very popular. And I don't have a sense of how popular that beach scene was, but they used it in the trailer. It was part of the poster. I wonder if that weighed very heavily in getting that win over the other films that were nominated that year.
I was wondering when they dropped the black and white cinematography award, because they obviously had best color cinematography as well. I wonder when that went away. It can't have been that many years after this, I suppose.
I think sometime in the 60s, because I remember seeing a couple films in the early 60s that were nominated for black and white. And also they had that for costume, too. Costume was separated in both categories. It's kind of a quirk of the time.
Yeah, definitely. I suppose in terms of the style of this, I think, you know, we've got to talk a bit about the attack at the end of the film, of course. Mm-hmm. That whole sequence. I guess it's about 10 minutes long, I suppose. I mean, obviously, there are quite real limits here to what they can show on screen in terms of bloodshed and stuff like that. But I don't know. I still think it's suitably intense and kind of kinetic and, you know, and stuff like that. And a part of it, of course, is they've got some military footage, it looks like, to help them construct the scene too, to kind of add to the genuineness of it. But yeah, yeah. What do you think of that whole sequence?
There's this part that when they're attacked and they're at the barracks, you can you hear like a something drop, or I mean I don't know exactly what's happening at the exact moment. Maybe it was like a bomb or something. Yeah. But the whole barracks shake and you hear a loud boom. That to me was very powerful because you kind of get a sense of the chaos of the situation. Yeah. So I thought that was really effective. And also one thing too is that the author, James Jones, witnessed the attack on Pearl Harbor. So there's a lot of authenticity in having somebody who was there and saw what went down and put that into his story.
That makes me want to check out the book, I think.
Me too.
Yeah, I wish I'd have done it in advance of this, but yeah, I'm going to put it on the list anyway.
It's also 800 pages, so it will take a little while, at least for me.
That makes me want to check it out less. I will do it. That's a lot. I mean, in terms of that ending, or, you know, in terms of as it comes towards the end anyway, you know, we have this thing where Pruitt had been AWOL, but he sort of tries to get back to his company's position, but is shot down. Yeah, a sad ending for his character, I think.
Yeah, I agree. And it shows that, wow, this character is still hard-headed. He won't stop when the guy's yelling, halt, halt. And there's that beautiful moment, too, with Burt Lancaster when Warden comes across Pruitt's body. And he just looks down. And I think Warden really saw a lot of himself in Pruitt. And there's a lot of really tender moments between the two. They have kind of this bromance throughout the film. I mean, Warden can't really show too much of that. So you kind of see that in subtleties in his actions. Like, I don't want to fill out 2 weeks of paperwork. You know, like, he makes kind of excuses like this when he really wants to protect him. And I think it's interesting at that very final scene, he has this tender moment where he's mourning the loss of his friend. And it's very sweet and sad.
Yeah, I like that aspect of the film too, because like there's the scene earlier where he gets Pruitt. I think Pruitt was going to be sent to the stockade or something, and he kind of finds an administrative way around that. And then he seems to soften to him even more, you know, after he plays the bugle that time. And he tries to find, you know, he tries to talk him into boxing. You know, he's trying to offer him a way out, but Pruitt obviously is principled and won't do it. But yeah, by the end of the film, it becomes really kind of poignant, I think, those two, definitely. And we also get that very nice restrained scene on the boat between the two women, don't we, at the end where, you know...
Oh, yes.
There are things that go unsaid, aren't there, that, you know, could have been pivotal, but I really like the way that ending is handled.
Yeah, and what I thought was interesting, too, about the Alma character is that how she's... Well, she's basically lying about how Pruitt died, but in reality, she's constructing a new life for herself. Because, again, this goes back to the whole identity conformity thing. She's going back to the States. She needs to look into the future because she's leaving all of this behind. What can she bring with her to the States? So she's bringing this constructed story with her to get a fresh start. And I thought that was very poignant. And you can see that Deborah Carr's Karen knows, yeah, no, that's not really what happened, but kind of lets it go. It's like, yeah, it's fine. You know, everyone has their way of mourning.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I think Carr plays that scene very well too. All right, Raquel. So we've touched on, you know, lots of the key scenes here, I think. But before we get to what people said on social media, I mean, were there any other scenes or moments that you wanted to draw attention to before we move on?
Yes, there's a couple of lines I really liked. There's one where Pruitt says, nobody ever lies about being lonely. I thought that was really poignant. I just kept thinking about that afterwards. And then I really liked that scene between Karen and Warden where they realize their romance can't continue, and she says, you're already married to the army. So he also is kind of struggling too with, in terms of his role and his identity, he's comfortable being higher up but not at the very top, because he knows that comes with a lot of responsibility and, you know, probably a lot of things that he just doesn't want to deal with. So that, yeah, those are just some things I wanted to point out.
That line you mentioned of Pruitt's was also mentioned by Violetta on Twitter, who said, "I love this film. Montgomery Clift's line, 'Nobody ever lies about being lonely,' always stayed with me. I also loved Donna Reed's performance, and the pairing of Deborah Carr and Burt Lancaster is unforgettable." So I think a lot of these messages we're going to hear, you know, they definitely focus on the cast. And I mean, obviously, it's clear to see why. Erica D, for example, said, "I thought Monty Clift was beyond measure in this film, as was Burt Lancaster. Burt's chemistry with Deborah Carr was lovely, as was seeing her break out of mainly good girl roles," which is kind of what you said, Raquel, isn't it? Mm-hmm. But it was kind of against type, I guess. And Erica says, "The same can be said of Donna Reed, who showed a provocative yet caring side. Ernest Borgnine is really scary and seems almost unbreakable. It makes me cringe to see scrawny Frank Sinatra try to go up against him. That's the toughest part of the film by far. It's a really unique film with an amazing cast." And I think she's right, isn't she? There is a kind of visual like mismatch between Sinatra Borgnine.
Yeah, that plays very powerful. Not only is like Fatso Judson, you know, bigger in size, but he's also higher in rank. And you know that Maggio's just, this is like out of his league. So he's up against something really big.
Let's see. So Gabriella said, "Such a good film. I think Deborah Carr and Burt Lancaster have incredible chemistry, and the entire cast is excellent, from Borgnine's vitriolic, poisonous racist to Montgomery Clift's haunted portrayal. It also shows how the military is a different way of life, one that subsumes everything else. I think Frank Sinatra also gives one of his best performances." I think that's a good word about Clift, isn't it? Haunted. I think that's that's accurate, I think, yeah.
And I like that about the army life subsuming everything else, because it's really a lifestyle that you sacrifice a lot for. And that really comes across in this film, too. So that's a good observation.
Yeah, I'm actually, myself, I'm from an army family. My dad was in the British Army, and not that you see any children or anything in this film, but some of the things like the sort of the sense of ritual and, mm-hmm. you know, community that I mentioned and so on, it did seem kind of appropriate to me. It did seem kind of real, to be honest, yeah. Right, so Tom Moran said, "Possibly one of the top 10 adaptations of a novel for the screen." So, Tom, if you're listening, let us know what your top 10 is. I'm very curious.
Oh, yeah.
High praise indeed.
And it's, yeah, that's a very long novel. And also a novel with a lot of very strong content to adapt to the screen and have it convey the message of the story and also entertain audiences. That's saying a lot.
Well, yeah, just on the topic of length, yeah, just you imagine they must have had to do a bit of work to kind of, whether it's leave stuff out mm-hmm. or to just kind of synthesize or to compress. So but by all accounts, it sounds like they did a good job of it. So yeah, no, I completely agree. Just a few more then. So David Riddle said, "One of my favourite films, and Montgomery Clift should have won Best Actor at the Oscars." Who won Best Actor? I can't. Let's see.
It was William Holden.
Oh, that's right. For Stalag 17, Billy Wilder's film.
Yeah, and that was a great performance too, so.
Yeah, and both Clift and Lancaster nominated for Best Actor, as well as Holden the winner, Marlon Brando for Julius Caesar, and Richard Burton for The Robe, so. Not a bad lineup, whichever way you kind of slice it, I think.
It's a lot of competition.
Yeah. David Wade said, "In a scene-by-scene comparison to the TV miniseries from 1979, one comes to really appreciate Zinnemann's direction, not to mention the excellence of the film, contrasting to, for lack of a better word, the sloppiness of the TV production." Now, I didn't know until I saw this message that there had been a miniseries.
Oh, yeah, I didn't either.
So I obviously haven't seen it, but I think it's tough sometimes, isn't it, when you come into something like that, that comes later when you've got kind of such a high quality film from previous times, you know, it kind of sets a high bar for what comes afterwards, I think.
Yeah, I know. A lot of these early films that are just so absolutely wonderful, it's hard to remake them because the bar is set very high. You kind of set yourself up for failure.
But maybe then the appeal of the miniseries must have been that, well, we got an 800-page book, but maybe there's room to do more of it. Maybe that was the thinking. I don't know. Yeah. That could be it. At Mentors Camper sounded a kind of a different note, sadly. Well, not sadly. Everyone, you know, everyone's entitled to their view. But he said, "I agree with its perfect casting and well acted. My problem with the film is that I don't like a single character in the movie. That doesn't mean I think it's a bad movie, just one I don't like." And I mean, they're definitely all flawed, aren't they? So maybe that's what he is kind of responding to, I suppose. They've all got whether it's issues or certain, you know, aspects of unsavory behavior and that kind of thing.
And I hear this a lot with films in which there's a lot of characters who are misfits. And if you don't either identify with your situation in some way or are able to empathize with them, even if you are a misfit, maybe a misfit for different reasons, it's hard to connect. But for me, like, I understand that struggle of being in a role but trying to be true to myself. So that's why I think it suited me very well. But not everyone's going to get that same connection.
Anyway, last message from Stephen G. Young, who said, what I think is Deborah Carr has been underrated as a romantic lead and not always remembered as one, yet more of her films made the AFI list of top romance films than any other actress.
I would like to applaud that comment because it's just spot on.
I think sometimes when you can assess somebody's whole career, that kind of happens, doesn't it? That, like, one thing I read recently about, it's not related to this film, but someone said about Maureen O'Hara that, you know, at the time, during her career, she was well-regarded and everything, but at the end of her career, people started to realize just how many great films and great directors she'd worked for and stuff like that. And maybe that's kind of what's at play here with Carr, I don't know.
Yeah, I wondered why they didn't do like a... I mean, they do Lifetime Achievement Awards and honorary Oscars, but there could be an Oscar for Best Lifetime Performance, where you just look at the scope of somebody's career after they've retired, picked the best of those performances and given them award for that. That could be really interesting because, yeah, once you can look back at the whole scope, that's when you really get to appreciate exactly what kind of work this person did.
Yeah, well, that's kind of what we discussed, I think, in regards to Robert Mitchum, I think, one time, didn't we?
Yeah. You
know, but it changed the way he was perceived as he went on and so on. But anyway, I mean, if we get talking about Mitchum, we'll be here all night. But,
right.
all right, Raquel. So, yeah, pleasure to talk to you, as ever. Just before we go, you're very active, of course, online. Where can people find you on social media and tell us all about your blog and stuff like that?
Well, I'm pretty much everywhere. So I have a classic movie blog called Out of the Past, outofthepastblog.com. I talk about new movies at kelmovies.com. You can find me on Instagram at kelmovies, on Twitter, which is my favorite platform, which is just my name, at Raquel Stetcher. And I also have a YouTube channel where I talk about movies. I even did a video recently with my husband where we just had people submit questions and we answered them. It was great.
Thanks, Raquel. And similar for the podcast, very active on Twitter, also on Facebook and Instagram. So if you just search for Movie Palace, you should find us somewhere. The Oscars will have been and gone by this time next week. So we're leaving behind films that, you know, are very highly commended and they won tons of awards and stuff like that. So a change of pace next week when, if all goes to plan, we're going to be looking at Batman the Movie from the 1960s with Adam West and Burt Ward. But in any case, listeners, I hope you enjoyed this episode, and I hope you can join me next time when the curtain rises once again at the Movie Palace.